Hey, welcome everyone to a Baseball America podcast. We're not calling these emergency podcasts anymore because you know there are playoff games. We had two yesterday. We have four today on a Friday.
I won't make it through all four. I can tell you that right now.
I don't know if I'll be able to do that either, but it does make for good hurricane viewing. So to those of you in South Florida and all over Florida, good luck. South Georgia, the Georgia and South Carolina coasts, and the southern part of North Carolina. We're in Durham, inland in North Carolina. We're looking at a lot of rain, and for Kyle, this is going to be your first hurricane, isn't it? West Coast guy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm used to earthquakes. I'm used to the occasional light sprinkling of rain in San Diego, but in terms of hurricane, not really sure what to expect.
Is it fair to say we right now, we are so far on the outer bands of this that we're getting a light rain?
Well,
San Diego, this would be like the lead story in the news.
Storm watch.
There is water falling from the sky.
Brick Tamblyn would be having a really difficult time figuring this out.
You know, just as it's really funny whenever there's a 4-point something earthquake in New York and everyone's freaking out, California's like, really?
I remember here when we had an earthquake here that was in Northern Virginia, but we could feel it here, and it was like, was that an earthquake? Like, Lingo and I looked at each other like, what the what? I didn't even introduce you. This is Kyle Glazer. There's so many playoff games today that we had to introduce a third member to our tag team. It's a six-man tag match to go old-school NWA wrestling. It was the Major League of Professional Wrestling. So, guys, yesterday, two games. One game that Texas Rangers fans would love to forget. It is amazing. One thing that I noticed about the Blue Jays and of late, I thought it was just in Seattle, but even in Boston over the weekend, there were a ton of Blue Jays fans. Where do all these Canadians come from? I mean, first of all, they should apologize, as I know they will, for their taking over all these stadiums. But number two, where do all these Blue Jays fans come from? Have you guys noticed? Am I crazy? There are Blue Jay fans everywhere when they go on the road.
You know what? It's one of those really cool things. When you're the lone team in a country, I mean, everyone gets behind you. Talk about, you know, Vancouver, it's on the entire other side of the country. It'd be the equivalent of here if the New York Yankees were the only team the United States had.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, the people in San Francisco would root for them. And that's kind of like what you see with Toronto.
The Blue Jays are like the Yankees in Interstellar. They're like the only team up there. You know?
Exactly.
It's really strange.
It's really cool. And I think, you know, we're seeing it, you know, all over. And I kind of like it. I like seeing when you have that big traveling fan base that, for them, it's not just a regional team, it's a national team. You know, it's funny, even growing up in California, I compare what I'm seeing here in football, you know, where all of North Carolina and all of South Carolina and a big chunk of the East Coast, they all root for the Carolina Panthers.
Right.
And, you know, California, you've got the Chargers, but you've also got the Niners, you've got the Raiders.
And the Chargers for now.
Right. You know,
sorry,
even the baseball teams, I mean, it's so regionally based. It's really cool, I think, even when you see one team that represents like four states, like the Denver Broncos do. They have Colorado, Wyoming, yeah. Idaho. It's cool. And then you take that on an even bigger level for an entire, you know, country that's A, massive, B, well-populated, and C, has a history of liking professional sports. I think it's really cool.
It's the interesting thing with that to me is that one of the things I think that's happened for the negative for a couple teams, the Atlanta Braves, mm-hmm. I really do feel like if you rewind the clock 30 years ago,
they were the team of the South.
They were the team of the South. And why was that? It was because
no one else.
You were talking, you got to watch their games, whether you were, well, really, wherever you were.
Yeah.
But if you were in the South, they were your team, and there was no one else to compete with for that, and you got to watch their games every night. And
they are diminished by the lack of the superstation. I completely agree that the Braves not being on TBS has diminished them as an organization.
In California, we got to watch.
The
Braves and Cubs were always on. It was TBS and WGN, and then your one other local team. So you got to learn about the Braves and Cubs.
When I moved to Georgia to California in 80, because in 82 was kind of like a, you know,
great. Oh, yeah.
I stayed a Braves fan. I was growing. I was there for Fernando Mania and all, but I stayed a Braves fan because I got to watch them, and the great thing about it is I didn't get to watch them every night.
Right.
I got to watch them at four, you know, like before I went to bed as an 8-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think that the Blue Jays have a little bit of that because they are Canada's team on TSN, these kind of things.
And the thing that you always see, we're starting to see it now in Cleveland because Cleveland's attendance this year, you know, really is not what's befitting of a team that was
that good.
As good as they've been. But year
it,
two.
It was up, though.
It was up, but year. Yeah, I would hope so. They're playing, but year two is when everyone kind of gathers, or you know, kind of. And what we've seen in Toronto is this is in many ways year two of this. If Cleveland's good again next year, which they should be, you would expect that you would see attendance go up significantly because at that point, the bandwagon has grown. And it's something right. Whereas this is where the Marlins never were able to successfully pull this off because year two for them always was, hey, we won the World Series, and now we tore everything apart.
Yeah. But the Indians are up 2,000 fans a game from this year to last year.
And, still put some...
They're always like 28, 29, 30. They've been 30 in some years of late, but not this year. So this year, I believe they were 27th, if I'm looking at this right. No, 28th.
28.
Still behind the Marlins, ahead of Oakland and Tampa Bay. So
that's but keep good. In mind for the Blue Jays, there was definitely a stretch there where there wasn't a lot to root for.
A fallow period.
And it's funny. I remember the first time I ever went to is the Sky Dome at the time. And as far as I'm concerned, it will always be the Sky Dome.
Sure.
It was a summer game on a weekend, a division game, and I mean, we got tickets for $10, third row, third baseline. Just, you know, there were maybe 20,000 people there.
Felt like home. Felt like San Diego.
No, at the time, actually, Petco was getting higher attendance.
Oh, okay.
This is new. But, I mean, it's just something where, you know, there's always going to be these periods. And I think, you know, it's absolutely, you know, if you're a fan, you know, why am I going to spend my disposable income when this team is, you know,
always let
65
down.
And 97. But when they do it once and then they do it again and then you add in this, you know, national pride factor, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if we see Toronto's attendance, you know, if they can continue it, keep going up. And hopefully the same with Cleveland, because like you said...
Well, they're third this year in attendance. Toronto averaged 41,880.
This is the first franchise
with 4 million.
And this is really back to, this is what it was like in the early 90s with them, where they were like, Toronto should be in some ways I hate to call them big markets now, but a bigger revenue team.
They're acting like it, but we'll see if they keep acting like it. That has not been Mark Shapiro's MO. It was not his MO in Cleveland.
Although Cleveland never will be a big market.
And it's not, but they did used to be. John Hart in the 90s when they were packing the Jake and those kind, and the baseball's economics were different.
They were
were a big market team every year. So it's kind of funny how those things, I say big market again, it was a big revenue team. These things do ebb and flow. And Toronto, for a while, when they hired J.P. Ricciardi, one of the reasons was we need to be efficient on a budget. We can't spend money profligately like Pat Gillick had done before. And so these things do ebb and flow in baseball. One of the reasons is attendance. And it is cool to see the Blue Jay fan passion. And they had a lot to cheer yesterday. Marco Estrada, awesome. We have this common theme of Long Beach State, some dirtbags that came up big. Obviously, Troy Tulowitzki. He's the most famous dirtbag.
Evan Longoria.
In the playoffs.
Oh, in the playoffs.
Oh, yeah, but Tulo and Estrada both had big games for...
And Brian Shaw.
And then even Brian Shaw got a couple of outs for the Indians. That was the more compelling game.
I was going to say, there's not much to say about the Blue Jays-Rangers game yesterday beyond the fact that...
They hit the hell out of the ball.
The Blue Jays, the Blue Jays had a great game. Cole Hamels, that is obviously, he didn't have it.
And he needed defensive help, and two plays that were hard plays weren't made, and when those get magnified.
And again, the interesting thing that goes on in the playoffs to me about it is how quickly do you pull your starter in a game like that? And the reality of it is they waited, they gave him some time, he gave up 7 runs. But in the reality is that's probably a good thing in the long run. You'd rather, once a game's a lost cause in the playoffs... The fact that he got some more innings and kept the rest of your bullpen
How about Alex Claudio? I think Alex Claudio pitched 3 2/3 scoreless yesterday.
You know,
for Texas, which is pretty cool.
Alex Claudio is a guy that I think is so under the radar. I mean, you look at all the metrics. He's been one of the better relievers in baseball. I won't say best, but one of the better relievers in baseball year long. I mean, this Rangers bullpen is...
He's a good lefty-on-lefty guy. I mean, he was better than that yesterday. But he is a good left-on-left option.
I mean, pick it, traditional stats, you know, analytics stats, whatever. There's no two ways about... You know, eye test. This guy's a good pitcher.
And how about Marco? So I want to talk a little bit about Marco Estrada, just for a minute. So 6th-round pick, $152,000 bonus in 2005. First year of the Nats, so he's not an expo. Never ranked higher than number 18 on their by us on the top 30 prospect list for the Nats. But I think the reason for that is he didn't have a big fastball. Then he's never had a big fastball. This is just never a guy that you would have thought from the minor leagues or from his major league when he first got a couple chances to start for the Brewers. We were like, wow, this guy's going to be a frontline starter. last couple of years, he's been one of their better playoff guys.
And, you know, some of it, there's another prospect I'm writing about for the handbook that a lot of comps him. I think it's because he was coming up in the age before we really understood spin rate and the effect it had and was being measured by TrackMan and StatCast right. and all those things. And now that we have those, we see that the spin rate, and that's really something he excels at, I mean, it makes everything play up. You know, it's a guy, you look at the radar gun, you're like, okay, but no one's hitting it. And it's one of those things where now we have a better understanding of why. And it just kind of goes to show, look, if you can hit your spots, manipulate your pitches, you know, locate when you need, and have a little bit of a bulldog mentality, that goes a long way.
I'm going to say dirtbag mentality. We got to keep it on message here. He's got dirtbag. He's got a dirtbag mentality.
You know, all those things, you know, absolutely will help you, you know, and sometimes make you a more effective pitcher than guys with better raw stuff, but can't locate it or leave it in the middle of the zone and you know, wilt at the first sign of pressure, which absolutely happens.
We basically know that Marco Estrada is going to be Mexico's World Baseball Classic ace as well, just to throw it into that.
If he's allowed to.
Oh, he's born in Mexico. So
but
he's,
if he's allowed to throw.
If the Blue Jays let him throw, yes. Right now, his greater allegiance, the Canadian fans are, I think, more into it than Mexico right now. But so that's kind of as much as we could say. I really do think about that game. I am stunned by Marco Estrada's ascent. I'm not stunned by Andrew Miller's ascent, and I shouldn't have been stunned. I was surprised by when Terry Francona brought him in. Well, it immediately didn't work. He came in and gave him the first extra base hit off a left-handed pitcher all year by Brock Holt. Had to make some pretty special pitches to Big Poppy. Maybe not have faced Big Poppy if he'd gotten Brock Holt out. It was weird to bring him in with two out, nobody on for Brock Holt. That was strange. Bringing him in early, I enjoyed. I just didn't think that was the moment, because I thought that Trevor Bauer could have gotten you. Even if you make a mistake to Brock Holt, you have a two-run lead. Brock Holt's not a home run hitter. And the next batter was Mookie Betts, right-handed, who we handled very effectively those first two times. So for that standpoint, I actually thought Terry Francona went to him too early. It wasn't that it was too early in the fifth. It was too early because it was that situation. But I'm not upset or disappointed or anything. I am impressed that Terry Francona's game plan was, I'm going to Andrew Miller as early as I can. As soon as I get to Andrew Miller, I'm going to get to Andrew Miller.
And the thing about that is that this is, to me, this is the theme. If the Indians are going to win this series, we just saw their game plan.
That's right.
This is a team that went from being a starting pitching dominated team.
That's right.
And then went, okay, wait, medic, medic, medic.
If you thought the Indians were a World Series contender at the beginning of the year, you thought so because of the power of their rotation. And when that was taken away by injury, they couldn't say, well, we can't win. They had to figure out a plan B, and this is their plan B.
And the thing that I've talked about before that I've written about is that when you get to the playoffs, I know there's a lot of people saying, you know, I saw on Twitter last night, I love the ongoing debate going on Twitter during these games. Like, I love how they're aggressive with it, but does Terry Francona realize that they have games, they have another game tomorrow you're going to try to win? And when you get to a you're trying to win 3 out of 5, it worked for them. If they lost the game yesterday, they would be in real trouble.
Well, what's the title of the book? The only rules it has to work? Right, but there's that.
But
the
other... it is something where what ends up being, because it worked, I don't even think it means that they can't throw some of those guys tonight. They got the day off tomorrow.
The other thing I really liked about it is they understood that game one almost is in some ways a must win, because the good thing is, we talk about the pitching injuries, they're going to have two more of Corey Kluber after this, the mm-hmm. way they lined it up. And so I think there's a little bit of, okay, if we can win one of these games when Kluber is not on the mound, preferably the first one, you feel really, really good about going into having Corey Kluber throughout make two starts for you the rest of the way. So for me, I kind of liked how they treated it as a game, you know, game seven mentality, knowing that if right. we get this one, and then we can have, I mean, because otherwise, if you don't get this one, you know, throwing Corey Kluber two games doesn't help you because you need to win three.
I like the mentality. You have to have the mentality of, I'm going to deploy my best pitcher when I think I have to. I'm not going to wait. I'm not going to save or any of that kind of stuff. dictate my mentality.
I think you have to take the context of the series into account. You do it differently in a one-game winner-take-all than a game one of a best-of-five.
No doubt. But it is still like, you know, I think you treat every game like we're going to win this game, you know, in the playoffs. Well, and I don't think you think, oh, we got another one to go.
The only difference on that is when you get to a game like you had yesterday in the first game, which is you get to 7-0.
Yes.
And at that point, then you go, okay, well, this is why we have some of these guys on our staff.
By the way, so Shaw is one of 13 dirtbags in the big leagues this year. 13 active dirtbags. I'll double check and make sure that I didn't miss one, like who Baseball Reference doesn't have. I'll go through our draft stuff. But that is a lot. I mean, that's a lot of big leagues. That might be number one among big league alumni.
It's an elite program. I don't think anyone's ever doubted that.
The thing is, they haven't been to Omaha since 1998. So this is a tangent. I don't think you can call a college baseball program an elite program when you haven't been to the College World Series in the present 64-team era.
But you talk about, and again, maybe this is my Southern Californianist talking, everyone who plays baseball, coaches baseball, watches baseball in Southern California knows, yeah, Long Beach State gets the best of the best. Because you mentioned
absolutely
that, and I've been to Omaha, but during the time you're still talking about Jared Weaver and Jason Vargas and Troy Tulowitzki and
Longoria,
and then the 13 guys.
And
the
they still do
now.
It. They're still producing big leaguers now. Garrett Hampson, I think, is going to be a big leaguer, had a great debut this year. I think it's an elite program for producing big leaguers. I think that's a distinction.
Maybe that might be fair. I just know that, you know, you talk about
like
when you're growing up in Southern California playing baseball, yes, obviously there's USC, UCLA, but if Cal State Fullerton or Long Beach State come to your door, you're every bit as excited.
I agree. I would love to be a dirtbag.
This is a truly tangent, but is how when USC comes to your door now, and it's not the same. I mean, that used to...
You cost how much?
You know what, though? With Dan Hubbs there, it means more. When during the Kruder era, everyone's like, ugh.
But again, we don't want to go down that tangent.
But. Because I have some good Chad Kruder stories.
Me too. By good, I mean really not good for Chad Kruder. Me too. But, I mean, I think there's still name brand. I mean, if USC, they show you the trophies,
but,
they show you
yeah,
the alumni,
but
you're going to
when they show the trophies, unfortunately, at this point, you're going, wait, how much dust is on that?
This is correct. Mark who? Who was Mark Pryor? So, thought exercise of the day. Andrew Miller, we're talking about Andrew Miller. Here we are in 2016, 10 years after the 2006 draft, which is when Andrew Miller was drafted. I always remember talking to him after a big start that year at North Carolina. He was our college player of the year that year. And he'd thrown 7 innings, something like that. He'd thrown very well that day. For some reason, the detail that sticks out most to me was this tall, skinny kid from Florida, who was a third rounder out of high school, by the way. He's always been a dude. Comes out of the clubhouse with a plate of chicken fingers and some honey mustard dip. And he was like wolfing down these chicken fingers as we talked. I'm like, yeah, eat up, man. You're skin and bones. Come on. So Andrew Miller was number one on our draft board that year, on the BA 200 at that time. Tim Lincecum was two. Big game Timmy Jim is basically done. He pitched this year in the big leagues.
But it was UGLY,
and he frankly had no alibi. Whose career would you rather have?
Tim Lincecum's
or Andrew Miller's?
Tim Lincecum. I mean, you're talking about, even though it's ending, you're talking about a guy that in a 6-year, 7-year span won 2 Cy Young Awards, multiple dominant playoff starts, contributed greatly to 2 rings, and won a part of 3. I mean, if you were to tell me, all right, I'm going to give you 6 years of a guy, take the names out of it. If you go to any fan base, say, all right, I'm going to give you 6 years of a guy, with 2 Cy Young Awards and 3 World Series.
I agree.
Or a 10-year dominant reliever. Every single fan base is going to take the starter.
I agree. I will say this, though. What it does mean, though, Andrew Miller, when it's all said and done, it is at least possible now. And he's got a long way to go. But it is possible that Andrew Miller will actually catch him.
Right. It is possible.
Because
I don't think it's likely.
But
the peak was so high because of 2 Cy Young Awards. So sometimes I also forget, in hindsight, just how good Lincecum was and how fast. Because after 2010, basically,
but I mean,
he wasn't a big contributor.
Well,
I mean,
he threw 2 no-hitters.
But in 2012, those
were like the Fernando Valenzuela no-hitter at the, you know. Like
I was at one of them. And
he
was,
didn't have
I was at his 148-pitch no-hitter, the first one at Petco.
He didn't have a good season after 2011. His career, basically, as a good major league pitcher was 2007 to 2011. It was 5 good years. In 5 bad years. Now, I'm agreeing. I would take Lincecum's career. And if you were drafting at that time, and I've said this to you before, JJ, I probably should write a column about this. For me, when I'm doing a prospect list, I'm really looking 3 to 5 years out. I'm not looking 10
Andrew
years
Miller,
out.
And what Andrew Miller's success right now does not help the team that drafted him in any way.
In no way. Form. That's right.
And that is sometimes the danger. One of the dangers I will throw out is the high school right-hander danger, is that I do feel like that there's rare cases where it's not, but there are a lot of cases where a high school right-hander, not only do they take a power right-hander you take in the first round, not only do they often take a long time to develop, but I do feel like that there is a lot of times where it's like, it really helps the second or third team that he was with.
Right.
But it's like, well, what does that do for the team that drafted him, unless they traded him? You're just like, man, you know, we got 2 good years there before free agency. I always think Homer Bailey.
Exactly. I was about to say Homer Bailey is a great example of that. Here's Andrew Miller's career in a nutshell. As a starter, 20-27 with a 570 ERA. As a reliever, 23-14 with a 261 ERA. OPS against as a starter, 834. OPS against as a reliever, 552.
Now that
552.
That takes me to the tangent I wanted us to go on with this, because I just was sparked by that, which is that I do think, again, we're getting ready to do ranking season here. We're in the middle of ranking season.
Right.
And a never-ending debate we have is, how do you rank relievers?
Correct.
And I always come back to when you say, like, okay, but a dominant reliever is really valuable. And it is. And I will say again, and it is so much easier to do. It is easier for a guy to be a dominant reliever than it is to be a number 3 starter. It is hard. Now, it may be. You can make the argument.
It's harder to be Marco Estrada than it is to be Andrew Miller.
Yes.
Or Eric Gagne.
Yeah, well, but I don't want to get into PEDs.
Well, but sorry.
But I follow you, though. NDFA Eric
Gagne. But again, like, watch last night. Again, another example was Joe Kelly.
Trevor Hoffman, better example.
But Joe Kelly goes out last night.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's okay, electricity. Let's blow gas. 98.
I believe.
Future Cy Young Award.
Yeah, but I mean, you know. But
Highlander, UC Riverside, repping for that.
But he's always had a great arm. And
wrote about him as a freshman in 2006 at UC Riverside.
Always had a great arm. Has never been able to do the consistency of starting. I mean, we were talking about Zach Britton on with this 2 days ago.
Right.
And Zach Britton as a starter, it's like, I've got to mix pitches.
And the thing is, when you're ranking a prospect, a relief pitcher who throws 74 innings over the course of a regular season, that's like a drop in the bucket of what the Indians threw over the course of the year. I mean, like, obviously he wasn't there all year, but that was Andrew Miller's workload this year. But in the postseason, he's probably their second most important pitcher after Corey Kluber.
Yeah.
And it does flip. So you can't. So in the regular season,
because you now
season,
have a day off every 2 to 3 days.
I just don't see, and that's the best thing
four
for
days,
me.
I should say.
So for me, I actually tend to value relievers more, I think, than most prospect evaluators, because, and I don't see how you can think of this otherwise. Because I lived through Mariano Rivera. I mean, like, how do you say that relievers can't be prospects when you live through the era where this one guy was the biggest difference between what we talked about yesterday, JJ, the Braves and the Yankees? I'm sorry, Rivera was the biggest difference between those two franchises by 1-1-5 championships and 1-1-1. I don't think there's a question.
I mean, I think you look at the really high engines. And one thing I liked, you know, Troy Percival was a personal favorite of mine growing up, and BA was smart enough. They had him as a top 50 prospect. I believe it was 91 or 92. And I think when there's guys like that, the Riveras, the Hoffmans, the Percivals, the
those
super
rare
high-end guys,
but
I think they reveal themselves and they are ranked.
The tough thing about those, when you say ranking those, though, is that, like, Mariano Rivera, who ended up being the greatest reliever of all time,
was a starter.
He was a starter.
As was Andrew Miller.
As was Andrew Miller.
As was Zach Britton.
As was Wade Davis.
Right.
When you talk about these best, that was Juris Familia, who's not in that same camp.
That's,
you know,
exactly right. But most of them are failed starters or conversion guys. Those are the two best five.
So when they're in AA, they're starters, and it's not weird to rank them.
Now, this, okay, I'm teeing you up, John. This is like, I'm laying the softball over. This is the underhand, slow-pitch softball. The guy who's not, who got the save, you know, who basically threw 40 pitches last night,
Cody
was
Allen.
Cody Allen, who, this is what Cody Allen was, and Cody Allen, what always stands out to me about Cody Allen is what a find for the Indians, because this was a fast mover who, usually the fast movers, if you're not a White Sox, but, you know, our fast movers are the top round guys.
Yeah, Cody Allen was not a top round guy. He was the second guy from the 2011 draft to get to the big leagues. Who was first? Last night's starter, Trevor Bauer.
Yes.
Two fastest movers from the 2011 draft. Both started and finished.
And Bauer probably shouldn't have been moved that fast in hindsight, because obviously it took him a little bit to figure it out.
I agree.
And he's still figuring it out.
The thing is with Trevor is, I don't know, I think he needs to watch more Bull Durham. Don't think. It can only hurt the ball club. But Cody Allen was a starter in college. I think he was a starter when he went to Central Florida. Then he went to junior college at St. Pete. He was drafted out of high school. The Indians were on him out of high school. Mike Soper, area scout. Got to give Mike scout. Mike's pretty sure he's cross-checking now. I'm not sure what his title is. But Mike was the area guy on Cody Allen, because I talked to him when I did the Cody Allen column when he got in the big leagues. I was like, Cody Allen? Who the hell is this guy? When he got in the big leagues, I had no idea. Dig a little bit and had a really fun column, fun interview with him, because he had no idea he would move that fast. But the bullpen role has clearly suited him. There's a little extra there with the makeup where some guys would get threatened by Andrew Miller coming in on his turf. And he embraced it. He went to Terry Francona. I think that little extra makeup helps, but that guy's got a real power breaking ball. The separator for me of why he's good, not great, is he doesn't really throw it for strikes very often. It's almost exclusively a chase pitch.
It was amazing last night to watch really good hitters who simply could not chase it. And even when he was bouncing it, even when he was throwing it 59 feet, they were chasing it.
And the Red Sox are not a hacktastic team.
No. Dustin Pedroia, who, the last out of the game, is not a guy who you say, you could just throw anything up there and he'll swing.
Even that last out, that was a great final at bat.
He
spoiled so many pitches. And but still, it was a great at bat.
Pedroia, Betts, Big Poppy, all those guys are under 100 strikeouts. In today's game, that's impact hitters with under 100 strikeouts. And their strikeout guys are Bogarts and Hanley and, of course, Jackie Bradley.
But again, what I really was impressed about with that, though, is that they acquired Andrew Miller. And I do think this is going to become kind of I do believe this will be how baseball is headed in this direction.
The Royals bullpen model.
But it's not just the Royals bullpen model, but Andrew Miller has never really cared whether he's the closer.
Right.
He was never, he didn't care when he was in New York before this.
That's a 80 makeup guy, Andrew Miller. But that is a guy who, it's a great teammate. I just love hearing Peter talk about him or reading Peter Gamma's tweet about him, because he met him in the Cape. He's known Miller for like 12 years. He's always been a huge believer in Andrew.
But
and
how ironic is it, by the way, that last night, what happens is he beats the Red Sox, and the Red Sox is really where...
That's right.
When you talk about the successful career of Andrew Miller,
yep.
Where it starts with is him going to Boston and eventually, working through some mechanical things, but eventually also embracing a new role.
Yep.
This is a guy who was traded for Miguel Cabrera, everyone remembers.
Let's not forget, Andrew Miller was a bust. He was a complete... total bust,
it was bust city.
And he reinvented himself.
I know part of it was that he had a leg, I believe it was a knee injury with the Marlins after that trade. They kind of rushed him a little bit, but he never had a changeup. I wrote about that in college. His changeup was a two-seamer. He didn't have a changeup. He just basically slowed down his delivery and threw a two-seamer at 83, 86. That wasn't really his changeup. And his fastball velocity was always inconsistent in college. I do remember a scouting director telling me, there's something in the medical with Andrew Miller. Dig a little harder and you'll see it. He's not going to last. I think he was talking about the knee because he didn't last as a starter. But I always wonder in retrospect if he hadn't been rushed. He's the guy I wonder if he hadn't been rushed, if you'd given him a year in the minor leagues, because he got to the big leagues as the year he was drafted by the Tigers. But his slider's just so dirty and he does throw hard. It's hard to teach that guy a third pitch when those first two are so good.
But you just hit on the other thing, which is I do think also it suits him very well to go out there for 20 to 30, or last night, 40
pitches
and say, let it all out, rather than having to pace yourself anyway. The funny thing is the guys who have – the other thing I think we may see more of is – I'm not trying to bring this all back to the Royals, but what they did with Danny Duffy – I do think that there are guys who struggle as starters when they come up and going to the pen. You talked about this in the office. We were just talking, randomly a couple days ago about how we are now in a mentality of there are 5-inning starters, there are 6-inning starters, where you just go out and leave it all out there in those right. 5 innings, almost like your reliever.
Right.
Danny Duffy, I think one of the things that happened for him is he went to the bullpen and kind of was in that mentality of, let me just give him my best stuff. And then when he went back to the rotation, instead of thinking of it like, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, save a little something.
Yep.
No, don't pace yourself. See what you can do. Andrew Miller, but it's very much suited him to just be, I'm just going to let it all out. Here's the power stuff. And again, the thing about it is he threw 40 pitches last night. Cody Allen threw 40 pitches last night.
It's okay. Kluber's throwing tonight. He's going to go. He's going to go. He's going to go 8 2/3. That's what Corey Kluber does.
But Andrew Miller's, you know, basically the only lefty in that pen. I'm not putting it past him that you may not see him in a key situation against Ortiz tonight.
Oh, absolutely. If David Ortiz comes up with people on base, if there's a situation where four guys down the road, it's a close game, and Poppy's, you know, three or four people down the line, Terry Francona's getting Andrew Miller up. There's no question in my mind that that's you can't let David Ortiz come up late in a game and you have Andrew Miller available and you don't have him face it.
The other part with that is we saw it with the Red Sox. I mean, it was different, obviously, because for one, they were behind. But they drew Pomeranz, Joe Kelly.
Right.
One of the things that they're doing is like, okay, those aren't middle relievers. I mean, you can call them that's what they're essentially serving as.
Yeah, Pomeranz threw 51 pitches last night.
Oh, like 5 strikeouts over 2 and a third. That was real nice.
He started out poor, but I kind of felt like, personally, they waited. I mean, again, this is the new postseason baseball.
They
waited too long. Porcello he then settled down, but it wasn't just the back-to-back-to-back home runs. Before that, he was getting squared up. He got squared up for a stretch there where it was like 7-8 batters in a row. I mean, Mike Napoli hit a foul ball that if that foul ball had been fair, it would have been an epic playoff home run. Like, wow, he left the state. I mean, it was...
it was crushed. It was hashtag crushed.
I mean, I think when you're talking about Rick Porcello, you do give a little bit of the benefit. I mean, still a guy who's led your team all year. And even with that, he had 6 strikeouts and 4 1/3, so he was missing some bats. I get that, yes, you know, you want to be, you know, you want to have a shorter leash than you would in the regular season. But at the same time, there are certain guys I think you can say, okay, let's give him, you know, one more inning.
I would say that Porcello, to me, is not one of those guys. Like, my argument, like, Kluber tonight, Kluber is. Porcello, this was Rick Porcello at his best. I don't think Rick Porcello, I think Rick Porcello has been up and down enough. To where...
Not this year. He's been extremely consistent.
I know he's been consistent this year, but maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't feel like he's that kind of guy. He's been better this year, as far as consistency, than David Price.
Much better.
I understand, though, like, there's a part of me with David Price where I give him a little bit more, because, like, David Price, the span of David Price, right. I go, you know what? You're David Price.
The other argument David Price in the postseason... Not so good. No, so another argument for Pomeranz, who, all, like Andrew Miller and like David Price, was the top college pitcher in his draft class in, I believe, 2010.
And again, irony is where the Red Sox rebuilt Andrew Miller. Yeah. Pomeranz was drafted first by the
Cleveland Indians, exactly, and traded for Ubaldo Jimenez, and has always been better as a starter. It was Danny Duffy. He had to go to the bullpen to get the mentality of going full strength. Health issues, but also I think the bullpen use really helped him.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I was in San Diego this year before you guys came.
It's pronounced San Diego.
Before you guys came and hired me, and I actually got to talk to Drew about this a little bit. You know, he talked about, you know, going to Colorado as well. I mean, that's where he made his major. That messed with his head. He absolutely, you know, talked about, he's a curveball pitcher.
Right.
And in Colorado, curveballs don't curve as much.
Right.
And it's something that he talked about, you know, that really, you know, beyond anything else, that really kind of got him out of, you know, who I am as a pitcher, what I need to do, and going to Oakland, you know, a team that, you know, frankly wasn't...
And you can mess up here, no one's watching. Shh.
But also just a team that, you know, it just, you know, I wouldn't say it wasn't competing, but just there's a lot less of a expectation. By now he's on his third team, he's a low-risk acquisition, just, hey, go to the bullpen, figure yourself out, and... I mean, clearly even the A's didn't realize what they had trading him for Mark Zepchinski and Yonder Alonso before the year.
Mama.
And giving the Padres Jose Torres on top of it, who's a very good reliever.
Ouch, babe. But that trade hurts.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's something where, you know, again, pitcher development is not linear. These are human beings get their heads messed with, and you have an injury, and all this. I mean, that's
I want to reiterate that with our 2006 draft rankings, which is a good way to finish us off. Here's our top 10 from the draft that year. Andrew Miller was one. Tim Lincecum was two.
I feel pretty good about that because he was number 10. He went 10th overall, and we had him two. I feel good about that.
Brad Lincoln, three.
Ooh.
Evan Longoria, four. Pretty good. That top position player. Greg Reynolds of Stanford, five. Yeah. Didn't quite work out. Clayton Kershaw, six. In a college-heavy era, this was 4 years after the Moneyball book had come out, 3 years. This was the whole industry was moving toward college in the draft. We had Lincecum as Kershaw as a top high school player, and the next high school player in that draft class for us was Kyle Drabek down at 12. High school position player Billy Rowell at 17.
This was terrible.
It was a terrible draft for high school position players.
But look at this. This is the Billy Rowell and Travis Snyder class.
And Chris Parmalee.
But the college arms, man, you look at Andrew Miller, Tim Lincecum, down to, by the way, Max Scherzer.
Oh, yeah, Jabba at 7, Luke Hochaver at 8 was an indie ball that year.
By the way,
Max Scherzer at 9.
Even Brandon Morrow.
That's an interesting one because Jabba Chamberlain, there were teams from what, you know, like retroactively, so like, we like Jabba, but we couldn't medical on him was going to keep us from drafting
him. And that dropped him to 41 to the Diamondback, to the Yankees.
And here's the question I have on that, which is that, it was Jabba a good pick? I think he still was.
At 41, yes. If they had taken him at 5, no. But at 41,
Well, they took Ian Kennedy at 21, and they took Jabba with their second pick. I think Jabba was a good pick, and I think I've said this many times before. I think the Yankees screwed him up in the big leagues. They almost screwed up Phil Hughes, too. Their pitch limits and the way they babied both those guys did not work. And Jabba's another one of these guys who... the success early, he clearly didn't handle the success very well. I think makeup was an issue there.
And then he got hurt.
But I think the other thing was when they put him in the rotation, he did try to pace himself, and it didn't work. If the Yankees had the Betances, Miller, Chapman bullpen, and he was a starter, he would have been like, hey, I can just blow this out for 5 or 6 innings. He would have been a much better starter, but that's not how they handled him. But I do think the blame, quote-unquote, lies with Jabba. But I think the Yankees are culpable in some ways as well.
My favorite Jabba story is about how ridiculous the hype got. I'll never forget, you know, I'm in college watching the postseason, you know, 07, 08, you know, peak Jabba hype. And one of the auction houses was selling autographed Jabba 8x10s for more than Hank Aaron autographed 8x10s.
That's a spur of the moment.
I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, so the free market, in other words, you're saying...
At that particular moment was ridiculous. Yes.
Yes. I'm trying to look. That we characterized that draft as a top-heavy draft. I mean, really, the next best player after Scherzer at 9, I'm pretty sure, is Mark Melancon, who was at 35.
But, I mean,
but we ranked at 35, and I will throw in Colorado prep product. I'm all about Mark Melancon.
But, I mean, they're still good. Always I mean, you're still looking at Chris Tillman, Ian Kennedy.
Jeff Samardzija at 37.
This is a really good pitcher draft. I mean, just pitching alone, that's a really good draft.
10 years, right, so 10 years later, this draft still having a pretty big impact on the postseason.
And, of course, Zach Britton.
That's right. Zach Britton, one of the better high school picks of that draft. So we'll watch again today. 4 games today. Are we going to talk about this tomorrow, JJ? Are we doing a special? That would be an emergency Saturday podcast.
That would be an emergency podcast. I was going to say that would be more difficult to do because
you're the weather nerd.
Because yes, I think
we're going to have power.
We'll have power, but that would be more difficult.
I'll be staying indoors, and the rain scares me.
I was going to say the strange thing that falls from
the sky. I'll be staying indoors.
I mean, it's like It's funny. I was talking to my wife's a school teacher, and she's like, you know, I don't know if they're going to cancel extracurriculars tonight, this afternoon, and all, you know, after school and all that. I'm like,
they moved up all the high school football games yesterday.
And it really is. It's like, it's
a little sprinkle. It's actually not bad.
I mean, right now we've gotten like a tenth of an inch of rain, but no, it is going to be fun today. I don't know if we'll be able to pull this off tomorrow because it becomes more difficult on the weekend. This has been the perfect start to my day every day where we come in, we sit down in John's office, we knock this out. I'm not coming into the office tomorrow.
Monday mega podcast. Monday, talk about everything.
It's going to be a mega pod on Monday, and I will remind people that the issue we just finished yesterday, which I'm very happy to have done, has Major League Player of the Year, Major League Rookie of the Year, those will be released first of next week, and recruiting rankings, which are coming out Wednesday, and draft report cards.
It's a really good issue.
It's an action-packed, jam-packed issue of Baseball America.
And all-rookie team.
All-rookie team is also in there.
Top graduated prospect, which is different than the all-rookie
team. That's right. And ultimately, this issue ends. It's like our capper of the regular season. That means we're on to prospect season. So the next issue of Baseball America, organization top 10 start. And so that is a great time to subscribe. Go to baseballamerica.com. There's plenty of ways to subscribe there.
Baseballamerica.com/store, and you'll see all the offers. But it is, you can get in now, and you will be prepped for, we will start rolling out the team top 10s in the very, before the end of the month, you'll be reading team top 10s, and that will continue for the next couple of months.
And that means it's also a handbook season. So lots going on at Baseball America. Good time to subscribe, and good time to subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back Monday with a Megapod. So for Kyle Glazer and for JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.